Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and reportedly legendary radio health evangelist, Dr.
Still
Tony.
Legendary?
Arguably legendary radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Heartily Trying Show. Because we are hardly trying anymore.
To be legendary?
Yeah, no, we're heartily trying to inform our radio fans about heart disease, how to protect your heart in what is called American Heart Month. Now, none of those foreign hearts. This is not North American, or this is not Western Hemispheric Heart Month. This is American Heart Month. Thanks to our listeners to True Talk Internet Radio, special radio wave to the MSU Ronald G. Eaglin Space Science Center, and with me, from the University of Kentucky, to provide a balanced viewpoint, assistant professor with the Physician Assistant Program, Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
Rick Phillips is at the Isonville Consumer Electronics Show. just back from Vegas. Well, now he's going to the real show. So that allows me to give you the tips on our website and how to access our show on the internet. And this is very simple. WMKY.org has copies of our show you can listen to. It's in MP3 format. Click on it. It's on your computer. And also, we do post at HM Radio Show on Facebook. Haven't been posting as much lately, I know, because I have changed jobs. Thanks to the nice folks at WMKY for posting a lot of local health news on that one. Our sponsor, the 7 Heart Healthy Habits, we'll talk about that maybe third fractional portion. But this is the symptoms of a heart attack. And this was published in the Morbidity Mortality Weekly Register. That's the newsletter, essentially, of the CDC. In 2008, and we reported on this on Health Matters, only 39.6% of Americans knew the 5 main cardinal symptoms of a heart attack. If you're having one or more of these 5 symptoms, you should get yourself evaluated. We're up now to 50.2%. We are slightly over half of adults in this poll published in the CDC knew the 5 common symptoms of heart attack, and that was in 2017. They've now tabulated that data. It was a part of a big survey, and they pulled out the symptoms of the heart attack. Now, I want to remind our radio fans so that if someone asks you, if you're a part of the 2018 poll, you can ace this quiz. The cardinal symptom, the one that we always think about, is chest pain or discomfort, and it is not simply any chest pain. The classic heart attack chest pain wells up in your chest. It is a tight feeling. Many people will use a clenched fist, an elephant sitting on your chest, a tight pressure in the
heaviness.
Chest. Chest pain or discomfort. And how many times, Shelley, have you gone in and said, well, tell me about your chest pain? Well, it's not a pain.
Yeah.
And I'm going, okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
They have my attention at that point.
You have a symptom in your chest. And Weaver's rule of cardiology is that any pain between the neck and the navel that you cannot explain in some other way, you need to think about your heart. If you're doing something vigorous or if you're under stress and suddenly something happens, whatever that something is, and it is new and it makes you feel sick, you should do something. But chest pain, chest heaviness, chest discomfort, that's the number one. The number two symptom, feeling faint, lightheaded, or weak. Now, that happens a lot. That's the one, actually, I wouldn't put that number two. I would, the second most common symptom is shortness of breath, mm-hmm. A sudden onset of shortness of breath, more than you would expect for whatever you're doing. You just feel completely out of breath. But we'll talk about the feeling lightheaded or weak. How many times does that happen anyway? You know, in the course of human events, you feel funny. Maybe you didn't eat enough lunch. Maybe you didn't keep yourself hydrated or something like that. There are lots of other things
that you're taking.
Yeah. But particularly if you are exerting yourself and at the end of that exertion, at the top of the stairs, at the top of the hill, you feel lightheaded, dizzy, or you feel an unusual weakness, then you might be having a heart attack. Number three, pain or discomfort in the back, neck, or jaw. That's the other thing. Your brain has a really difficult time figuring out where your heart is. So when your heart starts sending signals, it tries to reference the closest structure that it knows about. So it will sometimes cause a pain in the jaw, the left arm, but the right arm as well. The left arm more commonly, though, you get an aching numbness that wells up that stays for a while and then that gradually dissipates in your left arm. That's not a nerve pain. You didn't hit your funny bone. Those are sudden. They occur suddenly and they leave suddenly. So a pain in the back, the neck, or the jaw. Sometimes your brain misinterprets the chest pain. And then finally, pain or discomfort in the shoulder or both arms. So let's go over them again. Number one, chest pain or discomfort. Moving up to number two because I'm doing this, shortness of breath. Number three is feeling faint, lightheaded, or weak. Number four, pain or discomfort in the back, neck, or jaw. And number five, pain or discomfort in the shoulder or arms, which leads to Weaver's rule, any symptom between the neck and the navel. That's going to include the back, the neck, the jaw, the arms, and the shoulders, and the chest. Any pain or discomfort in that area, you have to think about heart attack.
Can I add another one?
Sure.
Because, you know, as you mentioned, some of these symptoms could be common for other things that don't involve the heart. But the majority of my patients who I've seen who've come in having an actual cardiac event or an imminent cardiac event, they're concerned. They're worried. They're scared. So whatever has happened, it's significant enough to make them feel worried about it and to come in.
It's really odd. This is what we call a visceral pain. It's sort of like a stomach ache. It is a feeling of oppression. It is not like if you hurt your thumb or you stick something in your knee or something like that. Those are certainly painful events, but this is something you can't quite put your finger on, but it is different. Nausea or vomiting going with it can also indicate if you have chest symptoms and you get nauseated, vomiting, that's really rarely indigestion, although most people think about it being indigestion. That still makes us worry about your heart. And if these things happen, then you need to move quickly. And we'll stop there. Please remember these signs, these symptoms of a heart attack. We start off with the measles. And a little bit of history. Before mass vaccinations, 400 to 500 people in the U.S. died of measles every year. Let me say it again. 400 to 500 people in the U.S. died of measles every year. Measles was a highly contagious virus, exquisitely contagious, in the words of Dr. Alan Melnick, who's the public health director in Washington State. We'll get to that in just a moment. Extremely contagious, so that if a person was exposed to the virus, 8 out of 9 people exposed got it. This is a tremendously infectious condition that can cause damage to nerves and swelling of the brain and can cause death. It was gone. The date of eradication, I've got it here, 2000. Unfortunately, it has made a resurgence. In 2018, 17 outbreaks, 350 cases reported around the nation. In 2017, 75 cases in Minnesota. Which was a Somali-American community with low vaccination coverage. In 2015, 147 cases. Multiple states were tied to an amusement park in California. Basically, somebody came into the amusement park with measles, and it spread like wildfire among the people there at the park, and they took it to other states when they went back home. The symptoms of measles, fever, runny nose, malaise, any viral infection will do that. A rash starting in the head, moving down the body. You are contagious for 4 days before and 4 days after getting the rash. So you've got a fever and runny nose. You think I got a cold. You've got measles. You're going to spread it to 9 out of 10 people you come in contact with. You can get sick up to 3 weeks after you've been exposed. At least now here we're up to present times. That's the history of measles. That is, when we were vaccinating effectively, we were able to basically eradicate this disease, but it recurred. 43 people in Washington and Oregon have fallen ill in recent weeks. Oh, so 19 years after it's eradicated, we have 43 cases in Washington and Oregon. More than a dozen more cases suspected. Mainly because those people traveled and exposed other people, and so there will be more cases coming out. The problem, the reason why Washington and Oregon are having this trouble, is they have the nation's highest vaccine exemption rates. In Oregon, 7.5% of people in kindergarten were missing shots for non-medical conditions. 4% of Washington secondary school students have non-medical vaccine exemptions. The national rate, 2%. So Washington is double, and Oregon is about 4 times the national rate of vaccine exemptions, and there's just no coverage. 17 states still allow some type of medical exemption for vaccines for personal, moral, or other beliefs, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. So, you know, there are two schools of thought here. One is that if you want to live in society, you obey the rules of society. And the rules of society are you can't travel with a highly contagious disease. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you should be vaccinated against a highly contagious disease that at one time was killing 400 or 500 people. Mm-hmm. And with that vaccination, this disease will not spread and will not kill people. The other school of thought is, this is exactly what we feared. The government is telling us what to do. There should be, we live in a free country, and there should be freedom of choice. Counter argument, not when your choice affects other people. There is a responsibility as a citizen to protect the people around you and not expose them to a highly contagious disease. California stripped away personal belief exemptions for children in public and private schools in 2015 after that Disneyland outbreak. Mm-hmm. That sent 147 people to healthcare facilities. There was an earlier law, again, they do propositions. An earlier law required parents to talk to a doctor before opting out. Vermont also has abandoned its personal exemption back in 2015. So there was this individual freedom. And then the problem is when you see children getting sick and children dying because we failed to protect them, you rethink things. Now, you can argue, you know, gun control and vaccination, you don't think of those things together. But in each case, the question is there personal responsibility? Is there a duty to protect? And where do we draw the line?
Well, with these diseases, you lose the herd immunity of the community. So you've affected a large number of people. And you don't know when that child at the daycare may develop cancer. You know, and then now they've lost the herd immunity that would protect them.
Right. If they themselves have something that suppresses their immune system, mm-hmm. They rely on the people around them not to spread these diseases.
Right.
And so you take that away, then a child that is on certain medications, a child that has cancer, a child that may be visiting a healthcare facility, they are at risk. And infants particularly can be at high risk because they don't have immunity yet. And what are our obligations to them? I will tell you just purely and simply, I've set this up, and you can debate this in your own home, and certainly there's plenty of political things to talk about. Health Matters standpoint, and Shelley, chime in if you disagree. We feel that vaccines are an essential mm-hmm. part of living in civilization.
Absolutely.
This is our duty to each other to get these vaccines. And we also feel that they are safe. We do not think that these vaccines, there were reports of them leading to higher rates of autism. That has, as much as you can disprove something, that has been disproved. We think these are good, safe vaccines that save lives. You can save some time by taking a break now. We're going to do the same and come back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Welcome back to the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Hardly Trying Show. You know if you say
did you say hardly? I know. Hardly trying.
You know, if you say that wrong, it comes out different, doesn't it?
It does.
I really hadn't thought of that. This is us trying one more time to educate our radio fans and the American public about heart disease. And we chose one specific thing that I really want to emphasize in this show. We've got several things we want to talk about, but this I think is really important. The warning symptoms of having a heart attack. There are five common symptoms of a heart attack. We are up now as of, it was published February 7, 2019 in the CDC's weekly newsletter. The research was done. It was a survey done in 2017. 50.2% of adults knew all five common symptoms of a heart attack. And let's go through them quickly. Chest pain or discomfort is number one. Number two, right behind that, a sudden onset shortness of breath. If you've got shortness of breath every day, well, then, my goodness, you probably have something wrong with your lungs. You need to see a doctor. But if you were fine doing this task yesterday and today you can't do it because you can't breathe, that is a warning sign for a heart attack. Three, feeling faint or lightheaded or weak. Four, pain, discomfort in the back, neck, or jaw, and 5, pain or discomfort in the shoulder or arms. Again, a discomfort, a new feeling that you've not had before between your jaw and your belly button, it merits checking it out. Now, the reason is about 2% of the time a heart attack presents with a person's heart stopping. They suddenly develop a very serious heart rhythm disturbance, and effectively their heart stops pumping blood about 2% of the time. 98% of the time, no. That 2% is why you go to the ER, why we put you on a monitor, why we don't let you go to the bathroom by yourself, why we put you in the hospital. All those things are because of that 2%. We can't have people just falling over dead. It's unesthetic.
Well, what about women?
In the case of women, there is one symptom, and I was thinking this when you mentioned this last time. There is a feeling of tiredness or fatigue that can come on for quite some time before they actually have chest symptoms, and that seems to be more likely for people who identify as women than it is for people who identify as men. But I don't know if that'll hold up or not, but it is something to think about. Once again, an extreme fatigue, not just I've had a rough day, I seem to be getting sleepy or anything like that, but just a more or less a constant sense of fatigue. And if you pair that with any type of difficulty breathing, a chest symptom, I would worry about that.
Mm, yeah, or any kind of doomy, gloomy kind of feeling as well.
When we ask a patient about their chest pain, they immediately correct us. It's not a pain. But it is some sense, an oppressiveness, a heaviness, a weight, a squeezing that sits on your chest. And those are your 5 symptoms of heart attack. Please remember them. And if someone asks you in a survey, don't embarrass the state of Kentucky. We should know our heart attack symptoms. For those of you listening on the internet, uphold your duty to those around you and know those signs and symptoms. I have a series of articles that I'm going to run through that just caught my interest. They have no unifying purpose, and since we are heartily trying today, I thought I would just put these together.
Hardly?
Okay. I'll let our radio fans bring their own interpretation. This is New York Times, January 30th. Over 3 weeks, an 18-year-old professional athlete suffered severe symptoms and nearly died. And here's what happens. Published in the New England Journal of Medicine, he had fever and pain, presented to the emergency room, pain in his lower right quadrant of his abdomen. That's where your appendix is. So they did a CAT scan and looked at his appendix, but it was okay. They also did some blood tests. They were normal. They figured he had a viral illness, sent him home. Over the next 2 weeks, the pain improved, some mild nausea. Went to a different city. There it was again. Bowel movements had blood. Temperature spiked to 103 degrees. Went to another emergency room. This time they ordered an MRI scan. So he had a CT the first time. Second time had an MRI scan. Nothing. Not a zip. Everything looked okay. Gee, isn't this an odd presentation? Don't think it's a virus. Viruses don't cause blood. Viruses don't usually cause a high fever. Viruses don't come and go over a period of weeks. So they gave him some IV fluids, and they sent him back home to New England, and he saw his team's doctor 2 days later. They ordered tests, but before they could even run the test, he was up to 105 degrees, more blood in the stool, worse abdominal pain. So they used a scope and looked in his colon. What was in his colon?
What?
A toothpick.
A toothpick.
It had poked through his intestinal wall, pierced an artery, creating a path for bacteria to enter his bloodstream. But hold that in mind. He did have a toothpick in his artery in the wall of his colon. Upon questioning, he remembered he'd eaten a sandwich a few weeks before.
He had eaten a sandwich.
I just love that.
Toothpick and all.
Yeah. you can imagine him. They had the light on him. He was in the interrogation room. Come on, tell me. You ate a sandwich, didn't you? Anyway, he remembered he ate a sandwich, and sandwiches often held together with toothpicks. His was not, to his knowledge, but apparently it was.
Apparently it was.
Think about this when you toothpick your food. You know, the toothpick needs to be obvious. There is a purpose for having a frilly toothpick.
Or the little umbrella thing or whatever.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Uh-huh. If you put something on the end of it, most people are going to notice it when they eat it. They're not just going to swallow it. And you got to, I mean, for me, you got to ask yourself, he's a professional athlete. I assume he's a big guy. You know, there are small athletes, but there are mostly big athletes. This is a guy who could wolf down a toothpick and not notice. Me, I notice when I wolf down toothpicks.
Yeah, I would notice, I would think.
Yeah, but for those in our audience who don't notice when they wolf down toothpicks, a frilly toothpick at least gives you a visual confirmation that there's a toothpick in your sandwich. If you're going to put toothpicks in food, they better be frilly. This is not a first time in the world this has ever been reported. I mean, the problem with the toothpick, see, it's wooden. It will not show up on any x-ray.
Right.
It is sharp, so it can penetrate through the bowel wall, so you can get abdominal infections. Now, being in an artery, this guy was just a very unlucky guy.
Yeah.
In that sense. An analysis of 136 cases of injuries from toothpick ingestion reported in medical journals found that almost 10% were fatal. This is a tough thing. In the Massachusetts man's case, his injuries nearly became life-threatening. When they removed the toothpick, blood began shooting from the artery. So they've got the scope in there. They grab the toothpick with a scope. They're ready to cure this guy. And all of a sudden, everything goes red. Everything goes dark, and we're in big trouble. Rush to the operating room, repair the intestine, replaced a 1.2-inch segment of the artery. I had to take a vein out of his thigh, and he still had a complex course after that. So,
don't use toothpicks. Ever.
Or at least use extremely frilly toothpicks.
Let's just not use them at all.
I do think that unless you have to have this toothpick for some visual presentation, it's a bad idea. Somebody's going to go bad. Friends don't serve friends food with toothpicks.
Especially if they're visually impaired.
Or apparently professional athletes. Those guys, they work the food over pretty fast. At any rate, so he makes it. But there is a point then you start thinking, well, gee, you can swallow things and they can penetrate the bowel wall. Hold that thought. This was February 7th, and this was a report published in the journal Science. Workers are on the surprising way to deliver insulin without injection. You swallow
the needle. I've heard about this. This is cool.
All right, so this is what it is. It's a tiny, swallowable. I just read that. I feel really, I'm proud of myself.
You're proud
I had
of
so
yourself.
Much trouble with heartily, but it's a swallowable device.
That's why you're legendary. That right there is why you're legendary.
I can rip those words out like nobody's business. It automatically injects insulin into the stomach wall. So far, it's only been tested in animals. Now, here's one that I like. They said it was roughly the size of a capsule. It was made of stainless steel and other biodegradable materials. Mm-hmm. Do you consider stainless steel to be a biodegradable material?
Well, No.
I think that was a typo. I just don't think that stainless steel and other biodegradable materials makes any sense. But it's got a spring-loaded needle that contains insulin. It's weighted so that it's like a Weeble, if you remember Weebles. It stays upright in the stomach. The needle can always find its mark on the stomach wall. They tested it in pigs, and it always righted itself so that when the spring holding the needle was triggered by the water in the stomach, the needle pierced the pig's stomach, delivering an insulin payload. And it led to blood levels of insulin about the same as an injection through the skin. So you do the injection on the inside. Now, why would you do that? Some people are terrified of needles and can't inject themselves. It does hurt when you inject yourself under the skin. The stomach does not have any sensory nerves, so you can inject the stomach, and you can do that several times a day with insulin, and you will be fine. And that's why you would go to all this trouble to inject yourself on the inside instead of the outside. Now, they're not ready. It's not ready.
There's one that's described as a miniature rocket. I heard this on the radio, but it's like a miniature rocket and has something in it that mixes with the normal fluid that's in your stomach, and then it will, you know, kind of like the baking soda volcanoes, I guess.
Yeah,
it will fire off and embed itself into the wall.
Right. And this is like MacGyver. You know, like he's in you're in the stomach, and you got this thing, and it's going to go off as soon as the stomach juice hits it. And so MacGyver's got to use a paper clip and somehow and disable the device before it injects.
Is it crazy of me to just want to be able to write that in a prescription? Miniature rocket.
Launch one rocket 3 times a day.
Yeah, exactly.
You want to be there when it happens, you know.
Yeah.
So you're sitting, you take your pill, and about 30 minutes later,
exactly. Exactly.
There we go. Got my injection for the day. Okay, that's enough. That's a swallowable device to inject insulin in the stomach, patterned after the age-old toothpick, bowel-penetrating toothpick. You can do this. And this, again, it's the way this thing works, it would inject, it would pull back, it would pass, I suppose, harmlessly. And in that case, it's not going to create, it's not going to pierce an artery or is not going to cause an infection in the stomach. Okay. I am moving around a little bit here since we had so much fun on that one. I think this is worth talking about. This was published in the British Medical Journal at the end of January. It was a trial of a study of, well, it was a compilation of, I think, 13 studies, 13 trials in the United States and United Kingdom about people who ate breakfast. Now, the current or the old thinking was people who ate breakfast were more likely to maintain a normal weight. Okay. It was kind of nonsensical. It says if you want to lose weight, if you want to be healthy, you need to eat breakfast. If you haven't been eating breakfast, you should add another meal to your day.
Yes. Eat more.
Yeah, because that would be better. And I've heard there is still an argument that food that you eat in the morning is the same food would be more healthy than if you ate it in the evening, because in the evening times it's more likely to turn to fat, whereas you can exercise during the day. I don't know where that stands. But what's interesting is there is now a lot of look at intermittent fasting.
Mm-hmm.
And breakfast was designed to break
a fast.
Right. So it may be that fasting is healthy, in which case breakfast would not be. And they looked at, so this was Catherine Sievert, who's a research officer in Melbourne, Australia. Looked at the diet, again, was wondering about the dietary recommendations suggesting inclusion of breakfast. And so she looked at 13 trials, United States, United Kingdom. Those who were asked to eat breakfast had a higher total daily energy intake than those who missed breakfast. There was a small weight loss recorded among those who missed breakfast. The average difference was about half a kilogram, 1 pound, basically more or less. And discrepancy across the trial results. They said, look, this is, and the other thing was, this was really a low quality. Certainly, the trials did not argue strongly in favor of eating breakfast to lose weight. And there was a weak and low quality evidence that maybe breakfast is bad. So here's the quote again from Tim Spector, who is a professor of genetic epidemiology in London, who was some kind of a breakfast consumption expert. Evidence is accumulating that restricting eating times and increasing fasting intervals can help certain people lose weight. Some of these recent developments that seem counterintuitive to traditional thinking make sense in the context of the importance of the gut microbiome on human health and metabolism. The community of 100 trillion gut microbes has a circadian rhythm. They change as the day progresses. They vary in composition and function in the fasting and in the fed states. Although this is a young discipline, some data suggests that microbial communities could benefit from short periods of fasting. I guess like clear-cutting a forest and allowing young trees to sprout again. I guess like altering the water supply and changing the flora. I don't know. But there is more. I think the neat thing about it is we have always thought of diet in terms of chemistry. How much fat is in the diet? How much carbs are in the diet? And how many essential minerals and so forth. We haven't really thought of your diet as what does it grow?
Mm-hmm.
And so it may be that what does it grow turns out to be more important than what chemicals are present in the food. And in that case, it may be that fasting renews in some way the gut flora, and we need to focus on fasting. And so skipping breakfast may be a really good idea, giving a few more hours to turning over the gut flora or changing it in some way.
Or eating breakfast and skipping other meals, like the circadian rhythm idea was really interesting.
I always thought that it was, how morning people are. People who get up, they get up in time to eat breakfast and then they go to work. They are more organized people. than a person who slaps on whatever they were wearing yesterday at the last minute and rushes out the door. And so if you start looking at a large group of people and asking, well, who has the discipline to maintain their weight, it may be the breakfast eaters. And you think then that it's breakfast. And so, yes, mm-hmm. if you get up an hour earlier every day so that you can have breakfast, then you are a more disciplined person. You are able to lose weight. And maybe if you got up an hour earlier and didn't eat breakfast, you would be the queen. You would be the king. You would be the person who really is on top of both, has the best of both worlds there.
Mm-hmm. Well, think of the potential implications for medications, too, medication dosages. And, you know, if there's this circadian rhythm to what's happening in our gut, it could affect how we treat
right.
disease states as
right.
well.
But I'll tell you, I think this is going to be one of the hottest areas of advancement in medicine going forward, is trying to understand how we live with these germs. And we're already starting to realize, as we have soaked the soil with antibiotics,
yeah.
We now have fish and bugs that live along streams that have high levels of antidepressants and antibiotics in their system. As we have saturated our water supply with antibiotics, we're realizing, my goodness, we need to know more about the germs that we have been killing mercilessly for many years by treating everything that sneezes or sniffles with an antibiotic. I just thought, first of all, this I do eat breakfast now. I did not used to eat breakfast. I do now. But I thought the idea of fasting, I'm going to work on that more this year and see if I can stretch out the gaps between my meals. And see what that does, because it's supposed to have everything from weight loss potential to also it's probably good for brain function. And Lord knows I could use some help there. I absolutely could. Do you eat breakfast?
Not consistently, no. I am not a morning person, so until I have enough coffee down me, I can't really function. So I drink my coffee.
I was not a morning person. I'm probably still not a morning person, but I'm getting up before 6 o'clock now because I've got clinic responsibilities and have to get there. But you don't. You can take a break, as a matter of fact. We're going to come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Welcome back to the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Heartily Trying Show.
Heartily. We're back to heartily trying.
Yeah. Well, I got a little sloppy in the second fractional portion, but I'll leave it to you to remind me of that. This is our salute to heart disease for American Heart Month. And this is officially, according to the American Heart Association, American Heart Month. So if you are, in fact, a sojourner in this country, or if you are listening from abroad, then this show is not for you. This is an American Heart Month. I thought it was Heart Month, and then I looked and it said, oh, it's American Heart Month. I said, well, why would you say that? You know, and how do you determine
know.
That?
I don't know.
What if you're an American and you get a heart transplant from someone who lives overseas?
Is it your month? That's a good question.
I have no idea. Just thought that one up. Why don't you weigh in? Hit us on Facebook. Tell us if you think that's an American Heart Month. No, don't. That's not a good question at all. Our sponsor for the final time, the five warning signs of heart attack. And again, I can't stress this enough. I'm going to go quick, and then we're going to go slow just to be sure. Number one, chest pain or discomfort. Number two, shortness of breath. Number three, pain or discomfort in the back, neck, or jaw. Number four, feeling faint, lightheaded, or weak. Number five, pain or discomfort in the shoulder or arms. One more time, chest pain or discomfort, shortness of breath, feeling faint, lightheaded, or weak, pain or discomfort in the back, neck, or jaw, pain or discomfort in the shoulder or arms. And again, it is because your brain has a difficult time getting signals from your heart. Your heart sends the signal that is in distress, and your brain cannot figure out if it's the jaw, if it's the neck, if it is the shoulder blade, maybe it is the left arm, maybe in some cases it's the right arm, or maybe it's just a weird feeling and your brain sends it up and you feel like you have a stomach ache, except it's a little higher than you expected. Add some sweating, nausea or vomiting, and you need to be in the emergency room. In fact, any unexplained symptom that wells up, particularly when you are under stress or exerting yourself, you cannot explain it, you should get that checked out. Now, if you're a teenager, the chances of that being a heart attack are much lower. But once you get into your 30s, 40s, 50s, these are the times when we really need to make sure that you're not having a problem with your heart. And we can, as we have never before, treat these heart attacks aggressively, and you can walk away with normal heart function. I remember when I started my practice, it was so easy to treat heart disease. You put people to bed, and unfortunately for many of them, I watched them die. I had no treatments. I had nothing I could do. That is absolutely not the case anymore. So it is critical, because of the 2% risk of your heart fibrillating or stopping, it is critical because, again, the more time we waste trying out Maalox or Mylanta or Pepto-Bismol or calling siblings and talking about how we feel, the more time we waste with that, the more damage is done to the heart. So we need to get in quickly. We need to make sure that the heart rhythm doesn't change, and we need to get those arteries opened up so the heart can beat again. So hopefully your heart will go on after February if you remember those five symptoms. Next up, this is February 3rd, 2017. I am recycling it because I think it is important. The American Heart Association's Life's Simple Seven. Seven modifiable heart-healthy factors, and we're going to go through them and make sure that you know what we're talking about. Number one, cigarette smoking. What do we do about cigarette smoking?
Don't. And because, don't vape.
Yeah, because it's really toxic for your heart. And the problem is part of that toxicity is nicotine. It just is. Nicotine clamps down your blood vessels. The same thing happens with methamphetamine. The same thing happens with cocaine. To a more, they obviously are more severe, but nicotine does the same thing. It does clamp the blood vessels down, and you need your blood vessels wide open to protect your heart. So anything like that, you're absolutely right. Vaping already linked to heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need anything to help your heart get less blood. So please stop smoking. Second, physical activity.
Just, that one we do want to do.
Yes. And I just talked to a fellow yesterday who he had had a heart attack, but he had it while he was in the gym. And so you say, gee, that's a failure of the gym. But his cardiologist told him, and I think correctly so, that the gym probably saved his life. One, he had symptoms where he knew there was something wrong and could get help rather than being in the middle of the night or being out in the woods somewhere. Secondly, though, working out in the gym helps your heart develop its circulation. It doesn't depend on a single artery. It has what we call collaterals. There are parallel branches that feed the heart. So when one artery clots off, there are others to help save the heart tissue. And he had good collaterals. He was back at work. He got his the artery opened up and actually went right back to work and feels fine. And part of it was his heart was more protected. We know that physical activity protects the heart even if an artery does clot off. And it prevents mm-hmm. the arteries from heart, clotting off. And it helps your brain, and it helps you live longer. And so mm-hmm. physical activity is wonderful. What kind of physical activity do you do?
Not enough, yeah. for starters. But I have a treadmill at home.
I've been trying different things. I am changing some things about my job to give myself more time to do it. It becomes especially, I am now in my 60s, and when a person is in his 60s, it becomes really critical to set these habits going into your older years. Physical activity is a very smart investment in your retirement. Number three is diet. The American Heart Association, they like the DASH diet. Its dietary approach is to stop hypertension. It is a limited salt, low fat diet. A lot of us like the Mediterranean diet. It's a diet that's heavier in fish, lots of nuts, lots of vegetables, and not much in the way of dairy products. You drink water or wine and a lot of fish and nuts with vegetables. But eating a diet that is lower in fat, that maintains your weight and then gives you extra omega-3 fish oils is a very good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Body mass index, okay, weight. You know, mm-hmm. just your weight. You don't have to use a slide rule and calculate your body mass index. You know where your weight should be.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even like the waist circumference things, you know, because you can make your waist circumference get bigger or smaller depending on where you put your belt. I would just say you need to maintain your body weight. You do not need to develop a beer belly.
True.
Yeah. Blood pressure. Yeah. Blood pressure, as a matter of fact, now there is a, we've talked about this before on this show, but I want to make sure our radio fans know, there are right now two schools of thought regarding blood pressure. According to the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology, the blood pressure should be below 120. As a matter of fact, when you get to 130 or greater on your top number on your blood pressure, then you have high blood pressure. And you can treat it with diet, but if you're not able to treat it with diet and activity, you should be on medicines at 130. Now, looking at the same research, the American Academy of Family Physicians, the American College of Physicians, which is a group of internal medicine specialists, they say, nope, we're still sticking with, for most of our patients, 140 on the top number. Above that is high blood pressure, and below that is... You know, again, we would rather have 120 than 130, but we're not going to start extra pills to bump someone from 130 to 120. We do not think that that works. So there's two different schools of thought. Your doctor or your healthcare provider will have their own opinion, but I want our radio fans to be aware that somewhere below 140 and possibly down below 120 is where the blood pressure needs to be. But you certainly should be paying attention to your blood pressure. You can't let it go high. That puts an extra pressure on your heart. Number six, so we got cigarette smoking, physical activity, diet, your weight or body mass index, and your blood pressure. Number six, cholesterol. We need to lower cholesterol.
Yes, we do.
Now, the American Heart Association, if you use the Google and search for American Heart Association Risk Calculator, get your total cholesterol, your good cholesterol level, and your blood pressure readings, you can figure out your 10-year risk of heart disease. It's a number you need to know. It determines a lot of how aggressive we want to be. And I have seen risk, 10-year risk, anywhere from about 2.5% up to 50% risk of having a heart attack or a stroke in the next 10 years. Now, heart attack and stroke are very common. It is the most common cause of death in the United States. So when you get in your 60s, you've got a substantial risk. And they say if your risk is above 7.5%, some people say if your risk is above 10%, you should be treating your cholesterol with medicine, period. Just whatever your cholesterol is, you need to be on a cholesterol medicine.
Mm-hmm. Take some medicine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are concerns, especially in older people, about how the cholesterol medicines affect your muscles. I had a patient the other day come in and said, I've heard that it might raise your risk of having Alzheimer's disease. Oddly enough, yes, it does, but it also lowers your risk.
Yeah.
The FDA has recorded instances where a person became more confused after going on a cholesterol medicine, but in the research, there was a clear benefit of cholesterol-lowering medicines in terms of preventing Alzheimer's disease and dementia. And so it's tricky, but these, they have revolutionized the treatment of heart disease.
I would agree. And you know, and they add so much more than just diet and exercise. And there's that hereditary component to cholesterol that's just so difficult to get a handle on without using medication.
Right. 80% of your cholesterol you make yourself from building blocks that you absorb through your gut. Now, if you deprive your body of fat and cholesterol, you can dial that down some. But your body is very good at making cholesterol. And so it is very difficult to just simply limit it in your diet. Weight loss helps a whole bunch, but just limiting the cholesterol in your diet doesn't get you as far as you might think. And then the final thing is glucose levels, your diabetes. Now, that's an interesting one because controlling diabetes does not necessarily prevent heart attacks. It does prevent a lot of things. It keeps you from having less likely to have nerve damage, less likely to have kidney problems, less likely to have eye damage. But the heart, the within the big vessels, we can't say for sure. I would, if you're able to get your glucose under control, we should work on that, absolutely. But I will tell you, I put a lot more value on blood pressure and cholesterol in terms of protecting you from a heart attack or stroke than I do on tight control of your sugar. Just throwing that out. Those are the simple seven. Cigarette smoking, don't do it. Physical activity, do it. Diet, eat it.
Or don't.
Yeah, sure. Depending on your position in life, we'll let you make that decision. body mass index or weight. Keep it, maintain it or lower it as needed. Blood pressure, cholesterol, and your sugar. Controlling those things can dramatically lower your risk of having a heart attack or a stroke in the future, we believe. All right. I got one thing to talk about here I wanted to mention. This is a poll. This was back in January 15th, a Gallup poll. 7 in 10 Americans identify the U.S. healthcare system as being in a state of crisis or having major problems. This is a random sample of over 1,000 adults across all 50 states, November 1st through 11th of 2018. here's the thing that I love about this. A consistent percentage of Americans said the U.S. healthcare system has had major issues during the past two decades. The views of those who are identified as Democrats and those who identify as Republicans have flipped. That is, at one time, the Republicans felt that the system was in crisis, and the Democrats felt we were headed in the right direction, and now the Democrats feel the system is in crisis, and the Republicans feel we're headed more in the right direction.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, once again, it depends on whether you think we ought to have more government involvement in healthcare or less government involvement in healthcare, and obviously when you decide that, that is going to color your impression of where we are right now. I will just say, looking from the inside of the healthcare system, I'm discouraged.
Yeah, it's a mess.
I mean, if you just look at the numbers, our life expectancy is falling. Mm-hmm. We have been dropping for 20 years here in Eastern Kentucky. And across the country now, the entire United States, we have either held the same or our life expectancy has fallen slightly. And I regard protecting life expectancy as one of the chief things that a healthcare system does. Mm-hmm. People should not be dying at a younger age on average than they did 20 years ago or even 3 years ago. We have the ability to prevent that. And for me, part of it is we have taken our eye off the ball. We have talked about pills and pills and pills and pills. Diagnostic advances, wonderful machinery, spring-loaded injectors that you can take in your stomach, all these things. But the simple things, those lifestyle things like maintaining weight, we have not figured out how to help people do that. And our patients have paid a horrible price for it.
Right. The focus has been on technology, essentially, not on the low-tech or non-tech things that we can do to help ourselves.
Right. And with that focus on higher technology, we have allowed stagnation and rot to creep into our primary care system. The first person you see should be knowledgeable about general diseases, doesn't have to be on top of all technology, but needs to have an ongoing relationship with you so you can talk about diet, you can monitor weight, you can look for change. And in fact, instead, we have this urgent care system. We have been, the doctors are all focused and the healthcare providers are all focused on their computers rather than their patients. And I just feel we dropped the ball. And the embarrassing thing for me is we blame the patients. Oh, yeah, they're eating bad. They're overweight. They're smoking too much. What can we do? Well, we should have fixed that.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we should have.
So we are not necessarily in disagreement with the 70% of Americans. 6 in 7 Democrats have a negative assessment of the system. That, again, is because of the recent Republican modifications in some of the Affordable Care Act. But we will leave you with that thought and try to get off the air. Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, it's WMKY.org. Visit us on Facebook. That's HM Radio Show. For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember, many people view Health Matters as a relatively safe radio show. And there's a lot of literature out there touting its health benefits and safety, but there are concerns that there hasn't been enough scientific research to really define the health problems that Health Matters might present.
The lack of research is associated with Health Matters' historical stigma in Canada as well as in the United States. In the U.S., Health Matters remains a restricted show, even though numerous states have legalized it for personal or medical use.
A commentary in a Canadian medical journal notes that the overall health benefits of medical health matters have been overstated, and the show's harms understated, as was the case for tobacco cigarettes before 1964. That was the year the U.S. Surgeon General issued a report definitively linking cigarette smoking and cancer.
There are more than 4,000 chemicals in tobacco smoke, and nicotine is only one of them. Same goes for Health Matters, which has 4,000 to 5,000 chemicals in it. Those chemicals potentially have tremendous impact on the lungs, just like cigarettes.
It is generally true that Health Matters is just as toxic as cigarette smoke. However, it is rare that someone listens to 20 shows a day. It's common that someone smokes 20 cigarettes a day.
Whatever you do, do not take this stuff lying down. Get out this week and make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.